Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Reinhard Wolf, and you're listening to Red Ice Radio. This show is normally hosted by Henrik Palmgren, but he's been quite busy as of late setting up the new members website. But rest assured, the new site will be up soon, and Henrik will be back in no time at all. Our guest for today is Blair Cottrell. Blair is an Australian carpenter, activist, and leader of the United Patriots Front. Recently, he was convicted of inciting contempt for Muslims after he and a few other UPF members made a mock execution video in protest of a recent mosque opening. We'll be talking about his legal battle, the Islamization of Australia, Antifa, and much more. Blair, welcome to Red Ice. How are you doing?
Good, thanks, mate.
So before we get into the main topics, why don't you start off by introducing yourself?
Well, my name is Blair Cottrell. I'm the main shot caller for a grassroots nationalist organization in Australia called United Patriots Front. And that's probably the most notorious or controversial political organization in my country. And has recently been in international news due to a legal conviction that I and two of my colleagues received for offending the sentiments of Muslims over Facebook.
Yeah, and I definitely want to talk about that legal situation that you're in. It's really ridiculous, and I think it speaks a lot to not only the state of Australia these days, but just kind of Western white civilization overall. But before we get into that, why don't you start off by telling us how you came to develop these views, how you came to be involved in right-wing politics, and so forth.
Well, I suppose for me it began when I was 18 years old. I began to take an interest in Marxism because around the city of Melbourne there were a lot of Marxist posters, and the slogan attached to these posters was "Ideas to Challenge the System." And I always viewed the system as being quite corrupt and problematic. Something was wrong. Mostly I was I took a standpoint in opposition to what I viewed as decay in society and degeneracy in general, like whether it was lack of physical health or bad social situations, drug addiction in particular. I didn't like seeing that. And so I took an interest in the Marxists who claimed that they were going to challenge the system, only to find out that their ideas were actually embedded into the system themselves, you know, primarily egalitarianism and feminism and all the other, you know, social justice left-wing ideals. And so I did not believe that their effort to challenge the system was genuine. I thought that was sort of subjective for them. But after that, I just began to read, and I had a great opportunity to read quite a bit when I spent some time in Australian prison as a young scamp for petty rubbish. And I suppose after this, I found myself being propelled into politics just by taking an opposition to Islamic immigration in particular, which was a very significant question. Probably around 2 to 3 years ago is when it really came into the forefront of mainstream politics and the concerns of everyday people. And we capitalized on that situation and became probably the most talked about or, as I said, controversial political organization, grassroots working class political organization in the country.
Interesting. You know, what you said about being interested in Marxism kind of at the beginning because it was ostensibly anti-system, anti-establishment, and so forth. That's very interesting because I hear that quite often actually from people in the alt-right in America. You know, they start off as anarchists or, you know, Marxists or something else. But, yeah, they eventually come to realize that the system actually isn't as adverse to all of that as, you know, your Marxist college professor might think. And I think the fact that, like, virtually all college professors are you know, within social sciences and, you know, even other disciplines are Marxist is proof that these ideas are hegemonic. And, yeah, you can just look at what the U.S. military, the CIA, international finance, all in, you know, and so forth, think of multiculturalism, tranny bathrooms, gay marriage. It's all, they're all, you know, in favor of that. And we saw after Charlottesville here in Virginia, you know, even the GOP came out, like Mitt Romney, all of these other, you know, charlatans came out in support of these radical left-wing terrorists against us, essentially. They called them, like, freedom fighters, or not freedom fighters. They called them, you know, peaceful protesters standing up against bigotry. So, yeah, they're not, you know, we in America like to refer to them as the shock troops of the establishment. I think that's quite fitting.
Yeah, I think so, too. They're actually the reactionaries of the modern day. If you're going to borrow a term from traditional Marxism, the reactionaries were the people who were sort of like trying to keep the system the way it is and to prevent any sort of grassroots uprising from having any sort of effect or, you know, accomplishing anything. But the main turning point for me was I experienced a lot of accusations of racism and sexism in the education system in primary and secondary schooling in Australia. And it always frustrated me because I thought, why is it, you know, why am I accused of racism when, you know, a lot of different people say racist things, a lot of different people from a lot of different backgrounds, but it's only racist when I say something because I'm white, you know, and, you know, also in contrast, the accusations of sexism I thought were also very one-sided. I recognized that when I was quite young. And then when I took an interest in Marxism, which was claiming to challenge all of this, all of these established social political dogmas, but then discovered that they were just even more against racism and sexism, I thought, well, that's not really challenging the system. That's just sort of an intensified version of the system's dogma. So that's what turned me against Marxism pretty quickly.
Yeah, there's definitely a double standard at play when it comes to, you know, the buzzwords like racism, sexism. If you're part of, like, the protected, you know, one of these protected victim groups, meaning you're not a white male, essentially, you can kind of say whatever you want about white males or just white people in general. So it's not really a good deal for white men. There's no reason for us to go along with it, frankly. But, Blair, you were recently charged, along with a few of your colleagues, as you mentioned, under Victoria's Racial and Religious Tolerance Act, and you were found guilty of inciting contempt for Muslims. So why don't you kind of start from the top and walk us through that whole story?
Well, I haven't prepared for this, so hopefully I'm articulate enough that you can understand me, but we generated an enormous amount of support in the regional town of Bendigo, which is in central Victoria in Australia, in the southernmost state of Australia. And the reason we generated all the support from this town is because we discovered that there was an initiative spearheaded by the local government or local council to build the largest mosque in the country, smack bang in the middle of this town, large enough, I think, capable of providing a worshipping space for up to 5,000 Muslims. However, there were only 36 Muslims living in the town. Accompanying this mosque were also plans for a small estate, a segregated estate within the small town, and plans for immigration from the third world, I believe, to basically inundate this very traditional and culturally significant, in my opinion, Australian town with these people from abroad. But when we found out about these plans and the people, the bureaucrats involved, we began to campaign against the mosque development, and we gathered together a very large amount of people. Probably our first demonstration attracted about 800 people, and the second was well over 1,000. The local council became very nervous, and the local media, which is Fairfax Media, one of Australia's largest corporations, Fairfax's own media organ in Bendigo, turned viciously against us. The police began to become obsessed with us, and before long we found ourselves charged for one of our publicity stunts that we did to promote the rally, and also, of course, to protest the barbarity of beheading live people in general. about a year after that particular stunt that we performed outside the council building, what that stunt involves was we made a dummy out of pillows and some fake blood made out of red food dye and water was inside the dummy's body, and when we motioned or pretended to decapitate the dummy, the blood spilled out onto the floor, and that was pretty much the entire thing. Didn't think anything of it. We didn't consider it to be particularly offensive compared to other things we had done. But a year later, we received four charges from the Department of Public Prosecutions, a state legal agency, all centered around inciting revulsion, ridicule, or serious contempt for a specific class of people, namely Muslims. That was the exact wording of the charge, the main charge. The other charges accompanying the main charge were just petty rubbish, criminal damage, and defacing public property, behaving in a defensive manner, I believe. Initially, I didn't even really take the charge sheet seriously. I was of the opinion that they would be withdrawn, that perhaps they were just a scare tactic of some sort, because I did not seriously believe that any sensible judge would convict me and my colleagues of these charges, or the main charge being the vilification charge in particular. But as things progressed, it seems that they were serious about trying to convict us of this charge, and they actually thought, as we recently were convicted. And the way we were convicted was, as I said, very well thought out. And the hearing we received, in my opinion, was very twisted. I don't think the judge was a bad judge, but I think he did make a bad decision, and therefore he has now set a precedent in Australia for hate speech laws, which are currently now being rushed through Parliament already because the precedent's been set. New laws are being rushed through now to stop the vilification of gay people or people who want to be in a homosexual relationship together, due to a gay marriage plebiscite, which is currently about to... the way we were convicted was very interesting. It turns out the side charges that we received, being criminal damage, perhaps defacing public property and behaving in an offensive manner, were only laid on us to give the prosecution the opportunity to call forward witnesses into the witness box, simply to prove that the video in question was made, the stunt did happen, and that it was us doing it. As soon as that had been proven by calling the witnesses for the side charges, all side charges were withdrawn, scrapped, done away with, and then the final charge for the people was pursued, and their conviction from two of my colleagues was in the end successful, therefore laying the groundwork for a never-ending sort of a tree of hate speech laws, which is bound to spring up out of the rotten soil of Australian Parliament. But that's pretty much the full story behind, in a nutshell, of course, behind that that entire ordeal.
So yeah, when you made the video, the mock execution, you weren't expecting any of this, right? Like the state, I'm not too familiar with hate speech and free speech laws in Australia, but at the time you were thinking, you know, this is I'm not hurting anyone, I'm not really even being that offensive. So you weren't expecting any of this to go through.
Absolutely not, no. There are left-wing activists in Australia who set fire to the national flag in public places and who have made dummies of politicians they don't like and proceeded to beat those dummies up where fake blood spills from those dummies on the streets, and these dummies that represent actual people.
Right.
Our dummy didn't represent anyone in particular. Like, we certainly didn't expect this sort of bureaucratic crackdown on our political activity and our speech in general to happen. But in Australia, there isn't any free speech laws. That's what makes Australia different from the United States of America. Basically, we have something like an implied constitutional right to express ourselves freely, but it can be challenged by certain pieces of legislation, and this was proven by our recent conviction in the courts.
So let's talk about the state of Islam in Australia. Obviously, Europe is undergoing, you know, a number of issues with mass immigration from Islamic countries, along with a very sympathetic ruling elite that is, you know, sympathetic to the demands and the interests of these new Muslim immigrants, and seemingly very hostile to those of the native, you know, indigenous European population. So how is the, you know, what's the situation like in Australia with Islam?
Well, from what I can tell, they segregate themselves first subtly and then completely. I first became familiar with the Muslims in Australia when I spent time in Australian prison when I was younger, because Australian prison is full of Muslims. Up until that time, I'd been warned or cautioned by my workmates that, you know, Islam was a growing problem in Australia, but I disregarded these claims as some sort of, you know, paranoia or conspiracy until I saw for myself what any community, what happens to a community rather, when there is a large amount of Muslims in that community, because prison is a community. A community segregated from the broader quote-unquote free community of society. And they pretty much control everything inside Australian prisons, from the drug trade all the way down to extra commodities and food. They bullied young Australian boys until they converted to Islam. Not all the time, but in some cases this did happen. And the prison complex itself had even bent to their will. Their mosque prayer times were broadcasted every day through the prison loudspeaker system, and every prisoner has one of these speakers in his cell, so he can't help but hear these calls to prayer. And so it seems as though the prison system was being used as some sort of recruitment drive by these criminal Muslims, and it really was. They were building their numbers and by these prisons. Every other prisoner seemed like he was Muslim, or at least interested in it. So when I left prison and found that there were already grassroots organizations forming to challenge the prospect of a large amount of Muslims immigrating into Australia, I felt sort of morally obligated to be involved and to offer up my services in these movements. But what they seem to do, there are suburbs in my state in particular which are virtually completely Muslim. You're not safe if you walk through these suburbs on your own, of course, as a white Australian person, or as anybody else for that matter. You can be Indian or Chinese or a member of some other race. They'll frown upon you for walking through their areas if you're not one of them. So it's just a matter of extreme segregation, in my experience. But it seems to be aided and encouraged, orchestrated rather, by local governments. That seems to be the core of the problem. Local governments, together with local religious groups, predominantly Catholic dioceses, who align themselves with so-called social justice committees, which nobody elects, meaning these aren't elected individuals, these social justice committees, yet they have an enormous amount of influence over the local press, police, and the local governments, and the decisions these people make, and the way they report news to the public, and the way they enforce the law. And these self-appointed committees seem to be hell-bent on bringing as many Muslims as possible into their respective towns, and these committees are popping up everywhere. And so, although Muslims are a problem in Australia, as they will be anywhere in the West, I don't believe they themselves are the primary problem. They're sort of being used as a bioweapon, I suppose you could say, brought into the country to cause as much destabilization and mayhem as possible, or even possibly for straight-up ethnic replacement in certain areas by whoever the hell these self-appointed social justice members of these social justice committees are usually radical leftists, self-proclaimed Marxists, communists, even anarchists in some circumstances. And in these committees are also, I should have added this in the beginning, influential members of the community end up in these committees. You know, so people who might work in local government actually go and spend their free time having meetings with these committee members. But of course, it's all in the name of humanitarianism and of helping people and of, you know, the humane conviction of providing some sort of refuge or assistance to people. And for that reason, the Catholic Church is always involved in some way. And but behind all of this good humanitarian work, I think, is a very disingenuous and diabolical motive, which is manifesting itself slowly in the form of complete ethnic replacement and the stabilisation of traditional Australia.
Yeah, and that seems to be a very similar issue that other white countries are facing. Yeah, a lot of it is done under the guise of humanitarianism, and I'm not ruling out, you know, the possibility that a lot of the people involved in relocating migrants and the quote unquote refugees are misguided, and but they're genuine, right? They think that they're actually doing good. They're helping out, you know, these poor, impoverished people from the third world, and but they're kind of missing the bigger picture of, you know, just demographic transformation, integration not working out, and so forth. So, yeah, regarding what you were saying about kind of like the self-segregation that's going on, that is, they are doing that on their own, out of their own volition, right? Because every now and then I hear, it's kind of a common left-wing talking point that, you know, it's the fault of the government for not helping to integrate them better. But, you know, that's always struck me as a very deracinated point of view. It's these liberals think that if only the government would help these Muslims out, the Muslims would throw away their identity and their ancestry, right? I don't think these people really want to give up their sense, their Islamic identity, their, you know, and then obviously their ethnic identity, you know, generally from the Middle East or perhaps, you know, Africa or elsewhere. But, yeah, what are your thoughts on that?
Their self-segregation is completely natural. It's ridiculous to expect these people to take up values which are completely alien to their religious doctrine and their own thousand-year history. And anyone who believes they can reform the character of a thousand-year-old nation, essentially, or religious people, by sitting them through a six-month re-education program is an idiot. But you see, the problem is this egalitarian preconception that people have been indoctrinated with since they were young. They cannot comprehend that there are people in the world who are born different than them, that they have different qualities, a different disposition which is in it, inborn. And you can't just re-educate that out of them. This idea that everyone's born as just this blank slate, or, you know, this blank sheet of paper, and then whatever you write on it, whatever you teach those people, that's what they become. It's not true. Okay, so I think that's really my only thoughts on that particular question. It's I mean, if I were a Muslim, I would want to conquer the West.
Right. Right.
I mean, I would take every opportunity. I would take every opportunity to do it. If I were born Muslim, then I'd be advancing my own cause through whatever methods were available to me. And, you know, I'd be having private mosque sessions with my brothers too, talking about raping all of these idiot infidels. Like, so, you know, you really can't blame them for just doing what they were pretty much born to do.
Yeah, and what Muslims have been doing ever since the days of Muhammad. I mean, without getting too far into Islamic theology and so forth, Muhammad, like these quote-unquote radical Muslims aren't doing anything different than what Muhammad did in his lifetime. They're going around, they're raping, they're pillaging, they're conquering. Unfortunately, now they're conquering us because we have a hostile ruling elite. you know, they would stand zero chance of doing anything to us if we had the right people in charge, right? I mean, their civilization failed to produce any serious results. And, you know, sometimes people talk about the, you know, the Islamic golden age in Spain and elsewhere. But, you know, just about any advance done ostensibly by Islamic civilization was done generally by Christians, or in the case of Persia, Zoroastrians, who were conquered by Muslims, forced to convert, and then were still allowed to, you know, conduct their research and their innovations under, you know, just under an Islamic cloak, essentially. But you mentioned something earlier that I found interesting as well. You said that, you know, a Chinese person wouldn't be okay going into an Islamic area. So it's not as if it's, you know, just bad white people who are, you know, being so mean to these Muslims that that they have no recourse but, you know, to resent us, right? So the murder of Curtis Chang, who I'm guessing was Chinese, was a kind of a big story in the saga of Islam in Australia. So why don't you tell us a bit about that?
Well, from what I can remember, sometime last year, you'll have to forgive me because I don't remember the exact month, but a young Muslim from the Parramatta Mosque in New South Wales walked directly from mosque prayer and executed Curtis Chang by shooting him with a pistol in the back of the head as he left from work. I think he was employed at the police headquarters there. And the government's response to that execution-style killing, the young boy was shot as well and killed by police in response. But the government's response was actually to give the Parramatta Mosque $4 million of state money or taxpayer money in order to fund a de-radicalization program which is proven to produce any actual results, and there really isn't any way to measure the results of such a program. But the mosque made money from that execution, quite a bit of money, to get $4 million put into your bank account because one of your religious adherents just went and shot somebody. You know, that's not a bad little earner for the Parramatta Mosque. So that sort of attitude that the government is taking is so profoundly inadequate, or even treasonous. It's encouraging more terrorism. You're paying them to commit terrorism. That's what our country.
Yeah, you're paying them. You're pretty much rewarding them for having one of their, you know, their guys go out and kill someone, essentially. So it's kind of setting up a very perverse incentive. And it's very Orwellian how the money was given to, you know, to stop terrorism, right? I think that was the reason that was cited when they gave it to them. But, I mean, do you really think that mosque is going to be using that $4 million to, you know, any of the $4 million to be, you know, promoting counter-extremism or anti-radicalization efforts? No, if anything, they're just expanding the kind of teachings and services and so forth that led to that that young Muslim man going out directly from prayer and shooting some guy in the back of the head.
That's right. And there hasn't been any effort to monitor how this money's been spent so far. And there won't be, because our government is lazy and naive. An Islamic school in particular has come under fire. I'm not sure it is exactly, but it's one of the largest Islamic schools in the country. I believe it's in New South Wales as well. But the state funding received from this particular school was found to have been misused. I don't know how this was discovered. It certainly wouldn't have been the government that discovered it. It could possibly hide it. So I suppose some fair practice agency discovered this information. Some of the money may have been channeled into other mosques, which is illegal, because any public funding you receive for educational purposes is supposed to be spent on your education or the educational programs that you're making available to your students. And so that's just another example of how any money these people get, there's no effort to trace where that money is going, what it's been spent on. For all this government knows in Australia, every dollar they give to Islamic schools and to mosques for so-called de-radicalization programs could very well be going back overseas to home to fund further terrorist atrocities or whatever the hell they're doing in their home countries. But just for the record too, de-radicalization, I don't know if that's a popular term over in America, but it's very popular in Australia, or has been in the last few years hitherto. It's the idea that Muslims who engage in jihad or killing or actually fighting with non-Muslims or enemies are quote-unquote radicalized psychologically and can be de-radicalized through the correct re-educational programs, government-funded or taxpayer-funded programs, of course. There's no scientific or any sort of psychological evidence or data to support this preconception. Yet it's repeated over and over again in the media. And we're talking always about what can radicalize Muslims and how we can stop Muslims from being radicalized. And one of the efforts or one of the suggestions made by mainstream media journalists is that we stop offending them and that we bring the right-wing groups to justice, quote-unquote justice, of course. Bring down the right-wing groups and stop people questioning Islam or challenging Islam because that is causing radicalization. See, so all of this pseudoscience, you know, that's going through the Western nations at the moment, pushed by the leftists, is almost like a disease. It infects the minds of everyday people, and the everyday people start believing that there really is radical and non-radical, and that there's this, you know, psychological difference between all Muslims, that some of them are okay and some of them aren't. The truth is, any of them at any time, depending on their circumstances, can choose to do what they want to do. There's not a different mindset or some sort of to be radical or to not be radical. Like I always say, all of the so-called peaceful Muslims that populate my country or another country, wait until society reaches a point of crisis. You know, wait until the institutions, you know, stop functioning or go into a state of crisis. You know, wait till society stops functioning properly. You'll see then how peaceful all the so-called peaceful Muslims really are.
Yeah, definitely. That would be quite enlightening for many people who, you know, buy into all of this progressive liberal nonsense about, you know, the universal brotherhood of humanity and equality and, you know, multiculturalism and so forth. Just because you're living in the same country and sharing the same state does not mean that you are part of their tribe. Generally only white people are stupid enough to really buy into that. You know, Muslims, they know where things stand. You know, Carl Schmitt wrote that the essence of politics is making the friend-foe distinction. And, yeah, I mean, these people are just, there's that friend-foe distinction is always, just about always, going to be done along racial and, in the case of Islam, you know, religious lines. So these people are never, there's never going to come a day when, you know, non-white Muslims genuinely believe that that all white people, all white Australians, in your instance, are part of their tribe and are therefore their friends. So, yeah, when the situation really came down to it, when it, if it really got dire, people are just trying to survive. Yeah, there would be no universal brotherhood of humanity. It would just be kind of them versus the other tribes, essentially. People are tribal. The only people that have given up tribalism, essentially, are white people in, you know, contemporary times. And the effects, the negative effects of us giving up tribalism are just so readily apparent at this point.
I think Islam is a foe to be respected for what it is, rather than just to be blindly hated. You need to understand it's a very effective doctrine, Islam. It creates a warlike people who are not to be underestimated. If you look at Islam from a global perspective, if you look at it from afar, it's almost as though it's like a test, just like any disease or infection. in the body is a test. It tests your own immune system. It tests how strong you are. If you're not strong enough, it'll kill you. And basically the test in this circumstance is if you're stupid enough to let it in and to not defend yourself against it, then you'll fail the test of nature and prove that you don't deserve to exist.
Yeah, I think that's a very apt way of putting it. You know, if we fail to stop Islamization, fail to stop the massive demographic transformation that's happening, not just in Australia, but in Germany, France, Sweden, America, Canada, and elsewhere, then we don't really deserve to exist. You know, despite how bad things are, though, I am optimistic that things are going to change for the better. People seem to be, every day, you know, more and more people wake up. But Blair, so what are the racial demographics in Australia like? I know we've been talking about Islam and that the threat that Islam poses, but there's obviously a lot of immigration from Asian countries, you know, the Middle East, and perhaps even other regions with which I'm not familiar. So do you know, like, what percentage white Australia is? Does the government, you know, do they actually release that information like they do here in America?
I don't think it's legal to stockpile those sort of statistics in this country. If it is, I've never seen any of those statistics. They do religious statistics, and I think Australia is still overwhelmingly Catholic, but that doesn't necessarily give any indication as to the racial demographics of the country. From what I've personally experienced, the closer you get to the city, the fewer white people you see. In the city, there is a great deal of Chinese. In the city of Sydney and Melbourne, which are the two probably most populated or largest cities in Australia, in my experience, there's a great deal of Chinese. The further you get away from the cities, when you start going out into the regional towns, that is where you'll find the more white, working class, typical Australian families, which do still exist in very great number, but only away or at some distance from the central cancer clusters, which are the major cities. So, and these cities are expanding very rapidly and swallowing up areas and degrading living standards as they do so. What is extremely common right now in and around Melbourne in particular is the subdivision of existing properties. Landowners are subdividing their properties and building the smallest possible units that they can and cramming as many people into these units as possible, into these many units on their land as possible. It's a great money-making scheme if you're a landowner. But if you have any sort of compassion for your fellow countrymen and sort of foresight as to where your country is going in the future, it's not a very good thing. I believe an article, just to wrap up this particular subject, an article was written recently by an Australian journalist for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, trying to discourage people from getting off the grid, that is to say, from moving too far away from the city, because if they do so, power, electricity prices are going to raise, go up for everybody else. So there is definitely an effort by the institutional powers to keep people closer to the city and to have as many people as possible swallowed up by the cosmopolitan disaster of the central city clusters.
Yeah, I think cities in general, kind of throughout time, have been far more liberal for various reasons, and they have a liberalizing effect. So yeah, when you hear talk like that of, you know, don't move too far away from the cities, it really makes you think what the person's motivations could be for that. But so is there a lot of conflict in Australia with the Aboriginals? I mean, politically, they're not too threatening as far as I'm concerned, but how do they kind of fit into, you know, Australia's multicultural disaster?
Oh, well, the Aboriginal people, for people listening who don't know, were the original inhabitants of this land. There is some evidence suggesting they had inhabited the land for over 60,000 years, I think, or perhaps it's 40,000, between 40 and 60,000 years. They didn't manage to offer up much serious resistance against the British colonials. I don't believe there's actually any genuine animosity from the Aboriginal community or between the Aboriginal community and the white Australian community. I believe it's sort of it's artificially generated by leftists with ulterior motives, of course. Right now, for example, Australia Day celebrations, Australia Day of January 26th, which marks the arrival of the first fleet in Australia, I believe, in 1788. This celebration, or Day of National Pride, has been cancelled, the ceremony, and they've been changed to Citizenship Day, and this is done in the name of compassion towards Aboriginal people, you know. And there's a great effort to create as much hatred or to harbour as much conflict between the existing Aboriginal community, or what's left of it, and the white Australian community or the traditional Australian community. I don't think it's genuine. I don't actually think there is a single full-blood Aboriginal person who is even slightly involved in any sort of political matters. All the quote-unquote Aboriginals that seem to be engaged in politics or that have all of these strong opinions about colonialism are mostly white, at least half white. It's peculiar that all of these people feel extremely oppressed, yet even the people who are only 5% Aboriginal by race still choose to identify as purely Indigenous and to disavow all of their white heritage. So, which is, I find, very peculiar, because if there was some sort of privilege, white privilege as they say, then why would these people disavow all that privilege only to choose to be oppressed as Aboriginal people? The truth is that they're not oppressed. Actually, there are a number of initiatives, or quite a few initiatives in this country to provide advantages and benefits for Aboriginal people if they are Aboriginal. If you go into any workplace or institution in Australia, one of the first questions you're asked is, are you Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander? And if you are, there are endless benefits, usually financial benefits, just for being a descendant of one of these tribesmen. But it's, in my view, it's not a very serious question. As I said, I think all of the animosity generated is done by the Marxists and the leftists purely just to denationalise the country further and to spread the shame guilt complex in the hearts of white people as much as possible. There is no genuine concern for any Aboriginal people, I don't believe, and anything that the members of the Aboriginal community or partial members of the Aboriginal community are getting, any sort of benefits, they just seem to exploit to the maximum. Every working Australian knows this. That's my answer to that question.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I wasn't really familiar with the kind of dynamic at play there, but they don't seem like they're a particularly political people. It seems as though the Aboriginals, at least the full-blooded ones, the most trouble they are is that they might drink too much out in public and cause a scene, but. Yeah, I'm sure it is just white liberals stirring up a sense of victimization among non-whites in general, but including the Aboriginals. There is a bit of truth to the kind of the conservative talking point about the left, race baiting. Obviously, multiculturalism has many built-in issues. It's not just if the left were to stop race baiting, everything would be okay. That's the conservative perspective. But, the left does play on victimization, does try to stir up these kind of grievances to use these people as foot soldiers in their, in their agenda. They don't really care about the affairs of non-whites. I mean, here in America, we see the left views black people as foot soldiers for, you know, their agenda. The minute a black person, you know, says, well, you know, maybe I think that, you know, Donald Trump has some policies that actually benefit the African American community. You know, Antifa over here and just liberals in general will literally call that black person a Nazi. Like, he becomes an unperson. He loses all sense of, you know, kind of victim status the minute he voices an opinion they dislike. But, Blair, why don't you talk a bit about kind of the state of Antifa in Australia? I've seen some of the videos from the UPF rallies where there's, you know, the black bloc is out in full force. It seems, you know, very similar to what I've experienced personally here in America and what I've seen elsewhere in the Western world. So why don't you kind of tell me some of your experiences with that, you know, whether or not these groups are getting state funding and so forth.
Antifa in Australia, I'm not sure whether they receive state funding directly, but they're definitely organized by members of local government. In particular, there is one member of Yarra City Council in the Melbourne region who gets out and commands Antifa himself, and they seem to do what he says, which is amusing. But he actually describes himself as a socialist councillor and uses ratepayers' money in the local area to produce all sorts of left-wing leaflets and various other forms of propaganda. One of our first ever rallies with our political organisation actually was a rally in opposition to this particular councillor. He conveniently was busy on that day and didn't attend the council building when we did, but about 300 of his political comrades, including Antifa, did, and caused a great deal of trouble for police. But we brought them out of the woodwork in Australia. Antifa, in my opinion, has always been there, or personalities similar to Antifa, these radical leftists. They've always been in society, but I believe they've been waiting for the opportune time or the necessary moment to become more militant. They need some event that brings them all out and that sort of shines the light on what they really are. And in Australia, though, they're quite pathetic, unfortunately. Well, perhaps that's not so unfortunate for us, but for them it is. They seem to just be copying what anti-fascists abroad are doing, or so-called anti-fascists. They sort of appropriate the same campaigns and initiatives that they see Antifa doing in America or in Europe, and they try and bring it over here in Australia, but it often doesn't really make sense. There was an effort to make a Black Lives Matter campaign here in Australia by an American African-American woman, an immigrant, tried to sort of victimize that original narrative that the left wing had created and create a Black Lives Matter movement here in Australia, but it just didn't kick off. And they're desperate to keep up with Antifa abroad, but they don't seem to know what to do in order to, or perhaps there's just not enough, the political climate in Australia is just not correct or extreme enough, since we don't have any sort of Donald Trump-style character in our parliament or leading the charge or representing the Australian people. They instead focus their attention on characters such as myself. I'm one of the most hated by anti-fascists in Australia, and I'm just still a tradesman to this day. I'm not even in any form of political office. So that's about it, I suppose, for Antifa in Australia. We actually went to one of their headquarters, members of my organisation and I. We found some anarchist club, which is frequented by so-called anti-fascists and has all of the anti-fascist literature and flags and posters and whatnot. And it was really quite pathetic. They didn't offer up any sort of resistance. They just screamed, and one of their members, Trotskyism or anti-fascism, was at the front to me, but didn't do a very good job of it. We've got the whole thing on camera, but our Facebook page was actually shut down recently, but for no reason. Well, we don't even know. We weren't given any reason, so I'll have to dig that video up from my hard drive. But yeah, very, very, perhaps not so much disorganized, but the best term I could find for Antifa in Australia is just pathetic, I suppose.
Yeah, I think they're pretty pathetic in general, but you know, in some areas they are more organized, more active, and so forth. So, Blair, let's kind of start wrapping up here. But before I let you go, I kind of want to hear what your perspective was on Charlottesville. You know, obviously, Unite the Right in America. It's been interesting to hear what people outside of America, in particular nationalists, kind of thought of the event. So I don't know if you followed it too much, but I'm assuming you heard about it to some extent.
Yes, I heard about what happened in Charlottesville. And my perspective is very simple. I think whatever term you want to use, they're profoundly disorganized almost everywhere because they don't have a central personality leading them. They're fractured because they have too many leaders. If you look at the greatest movements or ideologies in history, which actually are represented by the major religions, they're not actually doctrines. They're more like personality cults, or every adherence to the major religions, Christianity and Islam in particular, is actually only aspiring to become more like the individual mind responsible for the for creating that specific religion, whether it's Jesus Christ or Muhammad. I think what the right wing needs is an individual who's selfless, charismatic enough to draw people to him and to create a personality which people will want to emulate and aspire towards. There needs to be that person that steps up. A lot of people want to be that person, and I think that's a problem. You shouldn't want to be that person. This person just needs to be. They need to present themselves, and they need to do it for the same reason that Donald Trump ran for presidency. Not because they want to, but because they feel they have to. I don't know if Richard Spencer is that person, to be honest. I think he would like to be, but not to take anything away from him. He doesn't seem to be... perhaps, you know, he may reveal some aspects of character which in the future which will be adequate for him to be that person, but at this stage I don't think he is that person. And I think the chaos of Charlottesville was primarily due to the flaws in his own personality and his inability to organize the people or inspire the people to behave in a manner which is more of nationalists or of people who wants to represent the old way of honor and etiquette. But I think that's my personal perspective on the matter. There needs to be that individual, and I don't think that individual can come from the political class or from the wealthy class. I think he needs to be of the working class. I think he needs to be of the people. And these people are so rare, though. Whether or not one will come forward is another question. But I hope to see it, and I hope to see it in Australia too. But for the time being, I'll do my best to play out that role until this person presents himself to take the reins.
Yeah, there are certainly many people in the American alt-right who are kind of vying to be the leader, but I think there are so many different groups and subcultures within the American alt-right that it's going to take a real personality to really kind of unite everyone. And at the same time, frankly, I think I don't know how it is in Australia, but in America, yeah, there are so many groups that are just drastically different in terms of background, in terms of strategy, in terms of aesthetics. I really wonder if all of these groups are going to form one unit, one movement, one unit going forward, because it seems like, you know, you do have a lot of people that are pro-white and that are against the left, but that's kind of where everything ends. But I guess we'll just have to wait and see.
Yeah, just to weigh in on that, just to weigh in on the last point that you made there, there shouldn't be different movements or different organizations aiming at the same goal. There's no reason. The most popular movements at any specific time, what is obviously the most popular movement, or whoever is the most popular personality, all the little petty organizations which may form out of jealousy or spite, they need to submit to that group. They need to not stubbornly stay segregated from it and compete against it. They need not to merge with it and try to get some sort of status within it just to feel important. All of the smaller groups claiming to have the same aim need to submit to the stronger and the more popular. They need to offer up their services to whoever is doing better, whoever is clearly doing better, and the people in these groups need to be able to admit jobs in them, okay? That's the only real unity which is practical. And these groups cannot allow ideology to divide them, especially not economics or something as petty as that. At the end of the day, the survival of your own culture and your own people should be your goal. And whatever personality or group is producing the best results in terms of popularity in regards to achieving that goal, that is the group and the person to follow.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's a very good point. And as I said, we'll see. We'll see what happens. More and more people come to the alt-right every day. So I think that the potential for there being perhaps some great leader, or perhaps for one of the existing leaders to really unify things, I think there is a good chance of that happening. And I am optimistic about the future of things in America, Europe, and Australia. I think what we're experiencing is doing a lot for kind of international white solidarity, white consciousness. I think the future of the Western world, of the white world, is one of cooperation, one of shared identity, because at the end of the day, to the people who want to destroy us, the people who want to take our inheritance and to undo all of the great achievements of our ancestors, they don't really see Australian, American, French, German. They just see white at the end of the day. Now, I'm not arguing for, you know, we should all come together under a single state or anything like that, but I do think that, we're either going to do this together in support of each other, or we're just kind of going to fall individually.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, Blair, why don't you kind of tell us your plans for the future?
Well, first of all, we plan to appeal the conviction that we are received at the magistrate's level of court, which in Australia is the first level, or the judiciary doesn't really like this term, but the lowest level of court. After the magistrates, there is county court, which is the next level, which is a much more serious level. Then we have supreme, and then high court. Hopefully, we won't have to go that far, but we're going to attempt to overturn the conviction at a higher court with a different judge. Our chances of doing that, it's really hard to say. But in between, we have a number of projects upcoming. But it's all what exactly we are going to do and when we're going to do it depends on the circumstances. Of course, I think next thing on the agenda I can say with all certainty is to stage the largest Australia Day celebrations on Jan 26th of next year in the history of the country, so that rather than having cancelled Australia Day celebrations, the local council will be shocked to discover that they've only laid the groundwork for the largest grassroots celebrations in the history of the country. But we are an organisation, but we are still growing. And I'm sure you'll be hearing more from us.
All right, Blair, well, thank you again for coming on Red Ice, and I look forward to seeing what UPF is able to accomplish in the future, and I wish you the best in your attempts to appeal this absurd these absurd charges that have been leveled against you.